Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Coming up this hour, Wired magazine columnist Mark Drury on why we're infatuated with zombies, and investigative and New York Times correspondent Nina Bernstein on her article yesterday about the health insurance companies, why despite a court-approved agreement, they are making us pay more for out-of-network health care. But right now, we all know the basic facts by now behind the story of George W. Bush's National Guard service in Texas in 1972. Wait a minute, who am I kidding? No one seems to know the basic facts behind the story of George W. Bush's National Guard service in Texas in 1972. The story of Bush's so-called lost year, of course, is a story that had major implications for two presidential elections, as President Bush ran and then got reelected touting his military service. And it's a story that helped end the career of Dan Rather, who reported on the inconsistencies in the Bush National Guard records for 60 Minutes back in the fall of 2004. Dan Rather will be here with his latest memoir next week. The firestorm over the documents that Rather relied upon for reporting eventually led to his resignation. Well, the latest reporter to take a crack at the story with some new evidence and a few years of hindsight is Joe Hagan. His piece in Texas Monthly causing a lot of conversation. Joe Hagan, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
Unless people be confused, you're not the Joe Hagan who served as chief of staff for George W. Bush. That's a different spelling.
Right.
You're H-A-G-A-N. So in case anybody thinks this is an expose by the former chief of staff to the president. So let's talk about this long piece. It's probably worth dispelling people's anticipation that there's a big bombshell revelation in here.
Right.
Instead, it's just good old-fashioned reporting of the facts as we know them. There's no easy villain and no firm conclusion about whether Bush went AWOL?
Well, I guess that's right. There's a lot of suggestive arrows pointing in a certain direction. You know, to me, there are a lot of lots of little new things in here that sort of flesh out and connect the dots in the narrative of this story. But really, to me, if there is a bombshell or a scoop here, it is that nobody has ever put all of the facts together in one place. And there turns out to be a virtue in doing that, because you begin to see how what happened to Dan Rather in 2004 was the end of a long historical arc of this particular story. And you could not really separate the history of how that story arrived to 2004, you know, separate it from its own history. And so I get into that, how it began in the late 80s and evolved through, you know, kind of went through this Rube Goldberg machine of Texas politics and comes out the other end a very strange animal as a news story.
And I love the prehistory, which I actually didn't know, of how the media's attention first got focused on that Air National Guard unit. It was because in 1988, when Michael Dukakis was the presidential nominee for the Democrats and his running mate was Texas Senator Lloyd Benson, somebody blew the whistle on Benson's son getting preferential treatment get out of going to Vietnam by getting into that particular unit.
Right. It was John Sununu, currently from New Hampshire. I think he's supporting Romney this year. But
Who was the first President Bush's chief of staff.
That's right. And he was the one who went on a Sunday morning talk show in 1988 to attack Lloyd Benson as having got his son in. The boomerang effect was that it turned out that George W. Bush, son of George H., was in that same unit, had been recruited that same year by the same men. And this was not just any period in history. This was spring of 1968, Tet Offensive, cancellation of graduate deferments, you know, a time when people were looking to find somewhere to go.
And so it kind of canceled out as an issue in the 1988 presidential race.
That's right.
If both Benson on the Democratic ticket and George H.W. Bush, the Republican presidential nominee, had used their influence to get their sons out of Vietnam.
That's right.
But the crux of the matter is whether George W. Bush finished his National Guard stint flying planes at an Austin base or from an Austin base and later at a similar base in Alabama. And if he didn't, whether that record was covered up by his superiors at the time and by the Bush administration while he was president. So what specifically do you know that we didn't know, say, in 2004 when this was breaking out in the campaign and sinking Dan Rather?
Sure. Well, there's two things that I think I took away after all my research. One is the idea that there was a cover-up was one that came from a very dubious source and had created, you know, diverted the attention of a lot of people away from just what the basic facts were. In my story, I discuss how the Boston Globe had done some really significant, wonderful reporting on this and really showed and isolated this last year. The fact is that if you accept that Bush had preferential treatment while he was in the Guard, it doesn't follow that they were putting negative pieces of information into his file at this very time. You know, this is sort of what I got from talking to a lot of people at the time. The fact is, there are these huge gaps in his record because there were gaps in his service. He went away for a year. There was no eyewitnesses to him ever serving while he transferred to another place. And one of the things I was able to do is take all of his explanations and his official history and the documents that existed about him and isolate the fact that there are about 4 months in that year which no one can really explain why he was getting paid for service in Alabama while he was living in Houston. I think one of the things you come to understand are it's all devil's in the details. Turns out that, you know, they came out with these pay records, the White House, that showed, okay, look, just looks he did service on these dates in Alabama. Well, these were computerized records. And at the time, they were just punched into a computer. You know, there were no paper records, which there should have been, that said he did – this is exactly what he did to get paid.
That almost makes the scandal sound worse, that he was getting paid for not serving in the Air National Guard.
Well, this turns out to be not uncommon back in this day. You know, when somebody transferred, you were still actually the home base was still responsible for looking out for you, but they didn't always do it. And basically, oh, we need to punch in some dates for Bush. We can punch in some dates for Bush. And, while Bush is in Alabama, the stories of what he was doing there are well known. And it was a kind of a party time for him in Alabama at the time. He was playing a lot of tennis, doing a lot of drinking, chasing girls. But nobody ever saw him in a uniform at a guard base. There were rewards put out for anybody who prove that he did this service, none of which were collected. There's no smoking gun.
So nobody proved it, nobody disproved it. But 60 Minutes, you talk about negative things being put in George W. Bush's record at the time.
Right.
And why would they do that if they were covering it up?
Right.
But Dan Rather used some documents in his reporting that he claimed showed that military brass had pressured Bush's supervisors to sugarcoat his record.
Right.
And, of course, those were the documents that came under fire as possible forgeries, so
right.
They couldn't really use them as evidence in the story. Do you believe they were forgeries?
You know, here's my thinking on this. If you put a gun to my head, I would tell you, yes, I do think they are forgeries. There is a lot you can make a case that some typewriter in the early 70s could have created some of these documents, but there are problems with the content of the documents that I find hard to get around. For instance, one of them said the commander who supposedly wrote them said he was under pressure from a commander named Buck Stout. Well, it turns out Buck Stout was no longer the commander at the time that this letter was dated. That's tough to get around. You know, Mary Mapes of CBS News, the producer, said, well, he still wielded influence at the time. I'm not so sure about that.
Dan Rather's producer, who was forced to leave.
That's right.
I read a Mother Jones piece recently, in fact, that said a secretary at the base, Marion Carr Knox, had told them which typewriters she used, an Olympia and a Selectric, and that neither of those typewriters could possibly have produced those memos. So more evidence that they were forgeries after the fact.
And I take your point, and I'm interested in that. But the thing is, they were said to – these letters were supposedly written by the commander, not by the secretary. Maybe there was only two typewriters sitting around for him to use. In any event, this is the exact rabbit hole that I wanted to avoid in my story, because my philosophy on this story was these documents have been the tar pit that this story has been in ever since 2004.
Dan Rather's tar pit.
Exactly. Dan Rather's tar pit. It was like, another metaphor. It was a cork in the story, and I decided I was going to pull it out, not deal with those memos, because they're an endless fight. I've been covering this story since 2004. There are websites built, white papers written to decide one way or the other, and I wanted to find out okay, let's actually go into the prehistory of this. And in fact, when you do that, you start to actually develop even more skepticism about those documents because of the source.
And what really brought Dan Rather down was the fact that he was willing to go to air with those documents as evidence about Bush when the documents at least may have been a forgery.
Right.
So not to say they were wrong, not to say that Bush was exonerated,
right.
But you don't go to air with something that you don't have proof is real when it's that vital to your story. And we'll actually get to ask Dan Rather about that next week when he's on the show because he writes about it in his new memoir. But one other fascinating tidbit from your story around this point, the possibility that the Bush administration itself allowed or even facilitated these documents being used by 60 Minutes. Do you buy that?
This has been one of the most this has been highly investigated, and I did a lot of research on this trying to pin this down. At the end of the day, you're sort of circling around Dan Bartlett, the White House spokesman, because he was the one who was responsible for dealing with CBS on this issue. They had an expert, a man named Albert Lloyd, who was a longtime National Guard personnel officer, who they relied on to tell them one way or the other about Bush's guard record. And they would kind of wheel this guy out, and he would say, I've looked at Bush's guard record, and he fulfilled his duty and nothing to see here. Well, this man who died this spring, and I happened to talk to him 2 weeks before he died, which was kind of an amazing thing. And he was on his deathbed, and he did tell me that he had been shown those documents before the report aired, and that he personally told Dan Bartlett they were fake, that he considered them fake. There were big problems with them. There was an address that wasn't right and other things. And that Dan Bartlett then went to CBS, went on camera, and was asked directly, do you consider these – are you questioning the authenticity of these? And he said, not at all. And so that's a little weird. I mean that he didn't decide to dispute them. And then as we know, subsequently, the attacks on the documents happened very swiftly. Like, in fact, the first one was during the broadcast.
Somebody was ready.
Exactly. And my philosophy on this is it's possible that this happened. And I would not put it past them at all to have done that. However, I would also say this. I think it would have happened anyway the next day, because the thing is CBS that night put those memos in a PDF form online themselves, and people were just downloading them. It was the age of blogs.
Yeah.
One way or another, these documents were going to come under an intense scrutiny, and it was going to happen.
And it was a campaign, so they would have been geared up for quick response.
That's right.
No
and
matter
in,
what
and in
news
fact,
story.
One thing I didn't report in this paper is that Bartlett coordinated with all of these former Guards people who had served Bush, including the son of the commander who was said to have typed these letters, and to get them to kind of counteract.
Well, if the Bush people really did plant this so they could then shoot it down,
right.
That would be some October surprise, quote unquote.
Well, that's true, but may I add that I don't think that they planted those documents. I mean, I do think those documents came from the world of the source, who was Bill Burkett, who was a kind of West Texas cattle rancher who was a dubious character in my estimation.
But an even more explosive allegation that you explore in your piece that might tie everything together. This appeared in a controversial 2000 book, and the claim was that Bush had been arrested in 1972 for cocaine possession, but had had his record expunged through his father's political influence with a state judge in exchange for community service at a Houston charity. And this, theoretically, explains why he stopped flying, why he was in Alabama for part of that year when he was supposed to be in the National Guard,
right.
And why he ended up doing community service at a time that he was supposed to be on an airbase. Fascinating if true.
Yeah.
True?
Ha. I'm not going to touch that per se, but like, let me just put it this way. I spent a lot of time in Texas talking to a lot of the people involved in both, the Air Guard back in those days and, Democrats who were sort of circulating these stories in the 90s. All of this stuff came out of the Opposition Research Department of Ann Richards in 1994. And I heard all of these stories that were in that guy's book from people who were fanning them and saying they were true. And I could never come to the, you could never prove it. The fact is, if they expunged it, they're in a safe in Harriet Meyer's office, is basically what that book said. So you'll never know. And everybody involved would have been a ally of Bush's presently. Because I can't prove that, I don't want to touch it. And that was actually part of the point of my story, is I'm very interested in dispelling conspiracy theories so that we could just look at what was true. And we just looked at what was true. It was still damning, but more garden variety kind of personal history. You know, the fact that he may have, like, gone off for a year and they kind of softened it up for him. Oh, okay. He's not interested in flying anymore. He wants to go work on a campaign. So,
and, of course, the context in 04 was that his people were swift-boating John Kerry.
Right.
And the Kerry people said, well, if they're going to go to that and fabricate that kind of stuff about John Kerry, who actually did serve in Vietnam, then we've got to get Bush somehow. He can't wind up as the military hero in campaign when exactly the opposite is true.
Right.
We're just about out of time. And again, we're going to have Dan Rather on next week, not to only talk about this. He's 81 years old now.
Right.
He's written a memoir. We're going to talk about his whole career and the state of journalism as he sees it. But you wrote this article now, I guess, or at least it got released now, pegged with this book. Why do you think anybody might still care? George W. Bush was elected and reelected. He finished out his presidency. He's in retirement. He won't even speak publicly anymore about just about anything.
Right.
Why do we care anymore what happened to George W. Bush in the Vietnam era?
There's a very good reason, I think. I think this period of his life has incredible meaning for his historical identity and his political identity. You'll recall in 2003, Iraq had just been invaded. He lands on an aircraft carrier in a flight suit in an airplane. His father was a World War II pilot who was rescued after a heroic gun battle in which he fell into the water. So the shadow of this on Bush's life was huge. The shadow of his father's actions in Iraq were huge. There's like a huge sort of metaphorical value and historical value to this period of his life and what it means. And for him to have, quote unquote, achieved victory in Iraq after his father didn't, and for him to land on the aircraft carrier of an airplane and in this sort of heroic mold is kind of profound. And this story is profound if it undermines that or if it shows that he was trying to kind of compensate for something in a kind of like pop psychological way. And I, and if you'll also let me just point out in the story, there's a lot of circumstantial, I'll emphasize, but interesting evidence that one of the reasons he quit flying and never flew again was that he was having trouble landing his plane, that he had become afraid to land the plane. This isn't proven beyond the shadow of a doubt, but there's some really significant evidence pointing in that direction. And so when you put those two things together, pretty amazing stuff.
And there certainly is interest because your piece crashed the site at Texas Monthly when it went up, which shows that some people are still obsessed with George Bush's war record. And I guess it also shows that people are willing to read very long articles in the age of Twitter. So Joe Hagan, who you would normally see writing for New York Magazine, placed this piece in Texas Monthly about Bush and Rather and all of that. Thank you very much for coming and talking
Thanks
it through.
Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC coming up next. Culture critic Mark Derry from Wired Magazine and then New York Times correspondent Nina Bernstein on how insurance companies seem to be wriggling out of a court-approved agreement to make you pay more for out-of-network health care. Stay with us.